and the pulses of laser cannon weren't pulses at all, but sustained blasts. They watched sprinting targets in a 360-degree radius of their WAG disintegrate like blades of grass before a grass trimmer. Maybe four highly trained troopers manning the vehicle's weapons pods could have had the same effect, 4 men at the peak of their prime. Maybe. As the WAGs roared up the grade, Greta called off the slaughter. Because the lives of the opposition had value, the idea was to kill as few as possible, but to do it in a way that demoralized and absolutely terrified the survivors. That part of the mission was accomplished. The enemy was in full-scale retreat. She and the other gunners began firing over the heads of the withdrawing forces, driving them across the parking lot and into the main complex. As the WAGs closed on the three-story building's entrance, the squadron of gyroplanes swept in and, like huge black hornets, hovered above the roof. They sent intermittent beams of emerald green light spearing down through its walls and into the forces now trapped inside. Miro stopped the WAG in front of the complex's double doorway, beneath the big, crumbling marquee. Thick black smoke was already starting to coil out of the upper-story windows. Greta unfastened herself from the WAG umbilical and released her seat harness. She felt an incredible elation as she pushed out of her chair. Triumph was far too weak a word to describe the sensation.
Just call me Cortez.
Armed with advanced technology, facing a primitive and ignorant populace with a world of uncountable treasure that lay waiting at their feet. And they didn't even have to bend and scoop it up themselves. That's what subject peoples were all about. As Dreda moved to the rear, the mail trooper stood at attention on either side of the cargo bay. For the first time, they'd seen what their officers could do inside a battle suit. She studied each of their faces in turn. Some had sober, distant expressions. Others wore frozen grins. There was fear in all their eyes. The fear of her. Of her kind. Their weakness irritated her, and she had to stifle the urge to smack them to their knees. If Greta could have arranged it, she would have only brought sisters to the new reality. But there hadn't been time to complete the necessary transformations. After the troopers peeled back the netting from the weaponry, she picked up a tri-barreled laser rifle, checked its power pack, and then stepped onto the WAG's rear platform.
On to El Dorado. I do love gold.
As the back door lowered, Greta was the first to charge out, followed by Miro. The natives' gunfire chattered and flashed at them from the building's lower story windows. Deflected by their battlesuit's EM pulses, the sudden downpour of bullets veered wide, sparking off the already pitted concrete of the sidewalk. Greta ducked under the overhang of the marquee, but not before she took a second to look up at it. Incredibly, its century-old black plastic lettering was still mostly intact. With several missing letters, it said, Mount Deseret Casino Resort. Friday, Saturday only. Direct from Sparks, Nevada. Tony Orlando and Dawn. A severed human head tumbled down the grand staircase, bounced over the banister, and landed at Baron Charlie Doyle's feet.
Cute.
Wide with surprise, the dead eye stared up at him. Its neck stump was a clean bandsaw slice and absolutely bloodless. The throat's shock-contracted tendons had been fused with a spinal column, which meant the jaws would remain clenched like that, the teeth bared, until the flesh rotted from the bone. Baron Doyle made no attempt to kick aside the hideous thing. The ground floor lobby of the Mount Deseret Casino Resort was a scrap heap of similar horrors. And some of those scraps could still crawl. The ear-splitting whistles vibrated throughout the building, accompanying pencil-thin beams of emerald light that slashed through the vaulted ceiling 3 stories above, angling down, drawing lines of crackling flame along the faded red-patterned velvet wallpaper. The light beams were unstoppable. They cleaved everything they touched, metal, concrete, and humanity. The Baron's mutilated bodyguards dragged themselves back from the edge of the flashing buzzsaw, clawing their way over the bright, razor-sharp fragments of the casino's dropped and shattered 20-foot-wide crystal chandelier. A passing flicker of the green light had turned the little and ring fingers of Doyle's left hand into greasy, scorched stubs. He hadn't lost a single drop of blood, but the hand had gone rigid. It had puffed up, purple to the wrist, the surviving fingers as stiff and fat as little sausages. Excruciating pain throbbed all the way to his shoulder socket. His weapon of choice, an auto-loading 10-gauge shotgun with a sawed-off barrel and buttstock, and a pistol grip forestock dangled in his good right hand, its magazine emptied. The Ithaca Magnum roadblocker could blow a hole in a man big enough to stick an arm through, but in this battle, its high brass double-aught buckshot loads had proved worthless, as had torrents of .223, .308, and .45 caliber centerfire slugs. The attacker seemed immune to all alloys of lead. Only 10 minutes had passed since the lookout station on the lowest slopes of Mount Deseret, directly above the casino, had sounded an alarm. They'd spotted a low dust cloud coming from the north, across the arid waste at the northernmost end of Skull Valley. The rolling wall of beige dirt had looked like the front edge of an approaching windstorm, but the sky was cloudless and the air was perfectly still. As the cloud rapidly closed on them, Doyle had put the compound on full alert. His sec men ran to take up their positions inside the wire-fenced perimeter at machine gun nests and mortar emplacements. When the cloud was within 20 yards of the main gate, it had suddenly lifted and dispersed, exposing 8 onrushing wags. The gleaming black vehicles each had 6 enormous, churning, lug-treaded wheels. They had no windows or obslits. Except for what looked like rotating weapon pods on the roofs and sides, their outer surfaces were perfectly smooth. The heavy wags rammed, flattened, and rolled over the hurricane fence as if it were nothing. An instant after the fence came down, an even more astonishing thing happened. A half-dozen shiny black flying machines swept low around the base of the mountain, clustered in tight attack formation. Flying machines hadn't been seen in that part of Deathlands since Skydark. Understandably, Baron Doyle was caught unprepared. He'd fortified and stocked the casino compound to hold off a ground siege of many months. But this was no siege. This was a rout. When concentrated machine guns, small arms, and mortar fire had no effect on the oncoming vehicles and aircraft, when the beams of light began to slice and drop SecMen with uncanny accuracy, the only course left was a full retreat. Doyle and his troops scrambled to the cover of the casino building, which was no cover at all. As he squinted through the swirling smoke and dust, Doyle dimly saw 2-legged black monsters marching through the entrance. Tall, with big round heads and limbs and torsos segmented like insects, they advanced in a straight line, ignoring the flurries of bullets that zinged at them. Their long blasters returned fire with narrow beams of whistling emerald light. Unable to defend themselves, the Baron's Sekhmen were surrendering en masse, throwing aside their useless weapons and themselves belly down on the rubble.
"We can't stay here, sir."
What?
The Baron turned toward the man crouched on his right. Capo Weislick's right eye was nearly swollen shut, his cheek grossly bloated and as shiny as a balloon. The ear on that side of his face had vanished, replaced by an angry scorch.
"We've got to get out now!"
Weislick shoved him so hard that he dropped the shotgun.
Right, Weislick. Let's go.
Moving on rubbery knees, the Baron hurried over the unspeakable carnage of the lobby, past the mingled pieces of the living and the dead, through an archway that led toward the kitchens at the rear of the building. The escape tunnel was hidden behind a massive floor-to-ceiling pantry shelf. Its secret door was balanced to open at a touch, even when the shelf was loaded with goods. The underground corridor beyond had been built in the pre-dark days by the casino's original Native American owners. 11,000-foot Mount Deseret had shielded this small corner of the Skull Valley Indian Reservation from the brunt of the 3 warhead airbursts that had turned Salt Lake City into a hardened glob of thermoglass and the Great Salt Lake into a cloud of superheated vapor, which had flash-cooked every living thing between the pre-dark cities of Ogden and Provo. The native peoples of the Skull Valley Reservation had vanished in the same blinding instant as the Great Salt Lake. Their shapes were still visible on a few of the exposed boulders, permanently burned into the rock by an initial energy pulse brighter than 10,000 suns. The only artifacts of their culture that had survived Doomsday were the concrete pads scattered over the valley floor, pads that had once underlain shoddy, government-provided housing, and, of course, the Mount Deseret Casino Resort. When the tremendous weight of water was suddenly lifted from the lake basin to the north, it set violent geologic forces in motion. For decades afterward, strong earthquakes shook the area. The shifting of plates of subsurface rock caused pure springs to bubble up from the slopes of the mountain. The Slake City side of the mountain remained barren, its soil poisoned by radiation, but the more protected Skull Valley side soon supported lush stands of trees and wide meadows. 60 years after Skydark, the first resettlers moved into the resort complex. Before long, a small community had grown up around the Sweetwater stream formed by the confluence of New Cost-created springs. With uncontaminated water and land at their disposal, the settlers began cultivating crops for profit. They used remnants of highways 80 and 15 to build their trade routes. Charlie Doyle was neither farmer nor merchant.